Welcome to the Convergence Podcast. The Convergence is a space designed for university and college students, post-secondary students, and young adults to explore and deepen their faith. It's a space to think, question, doubt, and hopefully, ultimately, to worship. So glad you're here.
Hello to everyone out there in podcast land. Welcome or welcome back to the Convergence Podcast. We are in for a treat today as Bob, our spiritual director, is giving a talk on what's wrong with the world. We hope you enjoy.
When you said guest, I was wondering who is that, because I thought I belonged here. But hey, everybody. Yeah, thank you. Got one. Hi, Bob. We're going to finish tonight by partaking of the communion meal, and we invite everyone to partake. This is an open table. I think the way we can look at this tonight is, even if you're on a journey of faith and you're not quite sure of things, we wouldn't want you to come to the table if there's an uncertainty in your heart. But if tonight, as I talk and you say, I want to partake, I want to be part of the family meal, I want to take Jesus into myself, then we invite you all to do that. That will be our closing act of worship tonight. So, you guys, we handed out some notes. Everybody got them? Yeah, good. I just had too much to put on the screen. So I've got, what do I got here? I think I subtitled this a question, a movie scene, a New Testament text, a funny book title, a diary entry, an old poem, and the story arc. So that's what I'm going to do. 7 points, which is a beautifully rounded piece, right? 7 points. That's way too many for a sermon. My wife, I was a pastor for 36 years, and my wife said, says that I would answer her question with 3 points and a conclusion. So that's the ideal sermon. Who knows what tonight is in the Christian calendar? Maundy Thursday. So we're in Holy Week. Tomorrow's Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and then Easter Sunday. So tonight really is a special moment when the church usually celebrates the communion meal. And in some places practices foot washing, which we're not going to do tonight. Unless you want to, we can make a change. When Jesus surprises his friends by taking care of what the thing that nobody would take care of, right? So in those days, when you ate a meal, you probably reclined and your feet were closer to your face than we practice. So it was an issue. And Jesus does servant's work there. So it's such a prizing moment where our Lord takes on the servant's role, says something about himself and what he was doing. So tonight, as I ask the question, what is wrong with the world, I'm going to move toward the cross of Jesus and the story of God. It's going to be an Easter talk. The first point, as you see there, is the question, of course, what is wrong with the world? And it is a funny question to ask. I mean, who wants to be saddled with that one? You know, Bob's going to talk about what's wrong with the world. We could have said, what is wrong with you? That would have been quite a question, thing to talk about. But for the sake of this talk, I'm going to stipulate this. By the world, I mean the world of people. We're not talking about the planet. The planet has some sufferings right now, but we're talking about the world of people. And if anybody need notes there, still don't have notes. Everybody has enough. Okay. Yeah, if you can share them, if anybody needs that. Okay. And by what is wrong, by talking about what is wrong, I'm referencing there then the opposite of what is right. And that's a very interesting thing. In fact, wrong cannot have an independent standing. Wrong assumes that there is a right. Wrong doesn't exist in a vacuum. Wrong is the negation or the corruption or the perversion of what ought to be. So think of a lie. This is, I think Augustine talked about this. A lie does not have an independent existence in itself. It has to have some truth that it negates, right? In fact, the only lie that will work on us is a lie that sounds plausible. It has some element of truth, and you know, and in that envelope of truth, there's a hook of distortion or corruption or something that fools us. And so it has the power of a lie, but it depends on a truth, right? A lie hitches a ride on the truth, as it were. So this is how we should think of wrong. And this is, in fact, how we should think of evil. Evil is live spelled backwards, right? It's the anti-life principle, right? It is the negation of what is, and what is good. God in Genesis 1 says everything that he made is good. Everything that is real is good. It's a funny thing. When we're talking about what is wrong, we're into a mystery all of a sudden. And we're presented with the thought of what is right off the top. So we begin our question with some kind of emerging clarity that wrong is the negation of what made good, of what God made good. People, life, things, realities and powers like truth and beauty, right? So all the way through this, you'll see on there, I've got clues as we gather our clues. The first clue is to ask what is wrong is somehow to accept that there is a right. First clue. Which is interesting, you know, I mean, it was probably predating most of our lives here, but when I was in college and going through my grad studies and stuff, we were talking a lot about moral relativism, which is a big thing in those days. I don't even know where the state of that is anymore, but it seemed to be always a particular thing that we would use to leverage a certain viewpoint, and except when it came to things that we wanted to promote. We would say, well, moral relativism applies to certain cultures. They think differently than us. But, you know, if it came to something like, say, South Africa's a struggle with apartheid, nobody said, oh, well, that's just what South Africa does. Leave them alone. There was an abandonment of that idea because there was a sense that something universally right ought to guide our understandings. So that's the first thing. The first thing is the question, of course, what is wrong with the world? The second thing is the movie scene I want to give you. And what I've done here is I'm going to talk through various pieces and stuff, and I brought some books where all this stuff comes from somewhere. I like to cite my sources. And at the end, if you want to come up and take a look of where I got this stuff, you can find it. Don't take these books, but you can take a look at them, okay? In Cornelius Plantinga's wonderful book, Not the Way It's Supposed to Be, which is just a really well-written book, which is all about sin. And I'll tell you what, when I was a young pastor, I had a major blow-up in the church that I was dealing with where someone had abused some of our young women. Actually, a leader had abused some of our young women, and I got immersed into the chaos of trying to deal with this terrible thing that had happened. And I realized, even though I had theological education, I was a little bit naive about what sin actually was. I needed, what is this? What is this thing we're dealing with now? I found Plantinga's book, and it really helped me at the time. But he opens his book by talking about this movie scene from the movie Grand Canyon, which came out in the early 90s. And it's a scene where a guy in a rather nice car breaks down in a, you know, sort of a tough part of town. His car breaks down and he calls for a tow truck and waits for the tow truck. And while he's waiting, some young, tough customers come along and, you know, sort of think, well, here's some easy prey. And they start messing with him. And just then the tow truck driver drives up and gets out and says, now, hold on, everybody. This is not the way it's supposed to be. I'm supposed to be able to come and get this guy and pick him up and take his car where he needs to go. This guy's supposed to be able to get help because he called for it. Nothing here is the way it's supposed to be. And that's how Plantinga starts his book. I think when we talk about the question of what is wrong with the world, we could say the second clue puts it differently. Why do we somehow intuit that things are not the way they're supposed to be? That may be the better question. When we say this isn't the way it's supposed to be, why do we somehow intuit that it ought to be different? That's a really interesting question, actually. Interesting to me. The New Testament text. And so there you have, I printed out this text from Romans 1 from the Message Bible, just because it's a really lively way of putting it. Paul provides a key insight into this question of what is wrong with the world. And without taking the long text and sort of taking it apart, let me just read this piece for you. Paul says, what happened was this. People knew God perfectly well, but when they didn't treat him like God, refusing to worship him, they trivialized themselves into silliness and confusion, so that there was neither sense nor direction left in their lives. Isn't that interesting? They pretended to know it all, but were illiterate regarding life. They traded the glory of God, who holds the whole world in his hands, for cheap figurines you can buy at a roadside stand. Since they didn't bother to acknowledge God, God quit bothering them and let them run loose. And then all hell broke loose. And if you read Romans 1, you'll see quite an extensive itemization of what's wrong with the world in Romans 1. Paul will list all kinds of breakdown and disintegration and broken relationships and all kinds of confusion in the human condition in Romans 1. And so there you have it. But he says all of that stems back to a fundamental turn, the turn away from the knowledge of God. And, you know, at the very beginning of this year, as we've been asking our questions throughout this year, the very first question we asked is, what is a human? Can we be humans without reference to God? Paul says, we can't. When we turn away from God, things go sour very quickly. And if we're wondering the reason for that, it's the turn away from the transcendent, or the overarching, or that which calls us up into our humanity. Here's the great mystery of what a human person is. Are we animal or are we angel, right? That's Psalm 8. He's made us for a little while lower than the angels. But we have this sense about ourselves that we're made for more than this. This is part of the mystery of this question of what is wrong. It's the sense that we know that we're more than just mere animal. We are, in some sense, animal. But we're animals in the process of becoming much more than our animal nature. We are made in the image of God. So this sense of a turn away from God is what I think Augustine was referencing when he talked about this phrase. And I think we source it in Augustine. And then it was echoed in various theologians through history, but you might have heard of it, the Latin incurvatus in se. Have you ever heard of that? Some of us have heard about that phrase. It literally means to curve in on oneself. So instead of the vision of God, what the mystics and our spiritual tradition calls the beatific vision, the vision of God's glory that calls us up into something, we turn away from that and we get curved in on ourselves. And that's this sense where everything starts to disintegrate and come apart. It's the loss of the vision of God. So the third clue here then is, Paul says that our turn away from God brings us all kinds of trouble. So what do we need to understand about sin? Is sin something we need to actually understand a little bit? So that time I told you about that chaos in the church that I was pastoring at the time. It was just a brand new church plant. It was only 3 or 4 years old at the time, and it was just a wonderful place. And then all of a sudden, this thing happened, right? And as I told you, I said, I need to understand this. So I'm casting about for some understanding. One of the books I read by Ted Peters, he says, one thing will become clear in the course of this study. He says, that sin is not clear. And then he says, nor can it be because of the lie. There's almost like this murkiness. Can we really understand this? Can we understand why we would turn away from the vision of God? Why we would turn away from the self that we're called up to become? So in many ways, we could say there's no good reason for it. It's like insanity. There's no good reason for a lie when the truth is beautiful, right? There's no good reason to turn away from God, the God who loves us and blesses us and is actually calling us into glory. One of my favorite words in the English language is glory. That's an amazing word, glory. Have you ever experienced glory? I think I've maybe told this somewhere around here before. But when I played basketball way many, many moons ago, 50 pounds ago, 50 years ago, 45 years ago, I was I played at a high level of basketball, so I never got on the floor except a few times I got on the floor. And I got on one game and just at the last minute of the game, and then I get a rebound on one end of the floor and we're on the bonus. So I walk down to the other end of the floor to take my foul shots, and that's where the student section was. There were 4,000 students there that rose up to cheer little old me. That was a moment of glory. What is that? What is that to feel that? The resounding glory of God, and to experience all that. What is sin then? I mean, if sin makes no sense, what is it? It's not simply bad behavior. It's a mystery in many ways. Paul talks about the mystery of iniquity. There's something insane about it. Something strange about it. So we can talk about our bad behaviors, but really the mystery is, why are we led toward our sadness? Why are we led toward separation? Why do we threaten each other with nuclear armaments? Why do families break apart? There's just a lot of insanity about it. The irony is also that sin keeps us from understanding that we're sinners, right? Theologians talk about the noetic effects of sin, meaning sin actually affects our ability to know that we're in such a predicament. So this New Testament text really starts to poke around and provoke, and there becomes a mystery of who we are and what's going on. So the fourth thing then is a funny book title. This is one of my all-time favorite books, and I've read a lot of books in my life, and this one is absolutely stunning. Walker Percy. Walker Percy was a Southern novelist and essay writer. Walker Percy, he's gone now from us. This is a brilliant piece of taking apart the human self. So what I want to do is, I wrote it down for you. Here's how his book is titled. It's called Lost in the Cosmos, The Last Self-Help Book. But then he has two pages. What did I say? The Last Self-Help Book. Yeah. And then he has two pages of titling. Okay, here it is. I wrote it out for you. Or, he says, The Strange Case of the Self, Yourself, the Ghost Which Haunts the Cosmos. Or, How Can You Survive in the Cosmos, About Which You Know More and More While Knowing Less and Less About Yourself, This Despite 10,000 Self-Help Books, 100,000 Psychotherapists, and 100 Million Fundamentalist Christians. Or, Why Is It That Of All the Billions and Billions of Strange Objects in the Cosmos, Novas, Quasars, Pulsars, Black Holes, You Are Beyond Doubt the Strangest. Or, Why is it possible to learn more in 10 minutes about the Crab Nebula in Taurus, which is 6,000 light years away, than you presently know about yourself, even though you've been stuck with yourself all your life? Or, how is it possible for the man who designed Voyager 19, which arrived at Titania, a satellite of Uranus, I practiced that. That's a junior high joke. Okay. Three seconds off schedule and 100 yards off course after a flight of 6 years to be one of the most screwed up creatures in California or the cosmos. So what Percy does is actually he weaves through his book a 20 question self-quiz. And he just says, we're strange. We're alienated from ourselves. So when we're talking about what's wrong with the world, we realize there's layers here. We could talk about what's wrong around us, is usually what happens, right? What's wrong with the systems? What's wrong with the politics? What's wrong with the economics? We were dealing with all this a couple of weeks ago when we had this discussion. And but the real perplexing thing is, what's wrong with me? And I'm not just saying that rhetorically. I'm saying that actually. What's wrong with Bob? It's hard to figure ourselves out. The fourth clue. What does it mean that we don't know who we are? Or why we are here? Or what we should be doing with our time? What does that mean? Number five, a diary entry. You've heard of Anne Frank. Anne Frank is, to me, she's stunning. Do you know her story? She was a young Jewish girl. Her family, in about 1942, when the threat of being sent off to the prison camps was very real and happening around them, they were hid in a house in Amsterdam behind a bookcase and secret apartments. And some of us have been there. I've been there. But Anne was only just a young teenager when she went in there. I think she was maybe 13 or 14 when she went into the apartment. And then by the time, you know, they were eventually found in sometime, I think it was early 1945, she was about 16 or so. She wrote a diary. And I think she had an extraordinary writing gift. So I've done a lot of reading on Anne Frank about the book and about her story and, of course, her own diary. And I just consider her an extraordinary young person. But here's a diary entry from February the 12th, 1944. So we're talking about what is wrong with the world, but we're going to start to make this turn now, okay? This is what Anne writes. She says, "Today, the sun is shining." Think about this. She's been locked behind. She's been locked inside for a couple of years now. Being very careful, right? She hasn't been outside for a couple of years. "Today, the sun is shining. The sky is a deep blue. There is a lovely breeze, and I am longing. So longing for everything. To talk, for freedom, for friends, to be alone." To be alone. "And I do so long to cry." She couldn't say anything. Like they were like mice in that apartment for so long. "I feel as if I'm going to burst, and I know it would get better with crying, but I can't. I'm restless. I go from room to room, breathe through the crack of a closed window, feel my heart beating as if it's saying, 'Can't you satisfy my longing at last?' I believe that it is spring within me. I feel the spring is awakening. I feel it in my whole body and soul. It is an effort to behave normally. I feel utterly confused. I don't know what to read, what to write, what to do. I only know that I am longing." Fifth clue. It's one thing to ask what is wrong. But what if we shifted that question to this? What would satisfy us? What would make the wrong right? Maybe we can only guess at that. Maybe we can't answer that. Maybe all we know is that we're longing. Maybe that's all we have right now. That we're waiting and we're longing. And there's a yearning within us for someone, something, somehow to fix our human condition. And that's why I refer to the beautiful tradition of the beatific vision in Christian spirituality. This sense that one day we will see God and we'll be transformed by the sight of him. So we say beatific or beautiful, but it's the same idea as beatitude, blessedness or happiness. That the great longing of our heart, the transcendent longing, it belongs to the complete and total vision of the God who made us and blesses us. All that is true and beautiful and good and real. Okay, sixth clue. I start with the clue here now. What if, thought experiment, what if what was wrong could lead us to what is right? What if there was some kind of magic? And when I use magic as a theological term, I know it's not. But I'm a C.S. Lewis devotee, and C.S. Lewis uses the word magic in a theological sense, so I will too. What if there was some kind of magic in the world that allowed us to see our problems in the light of the solution? And in the same moment we realize our need, in that same moment we see our answer. And so we come to Easter. So I'm giving you the poem of George Herbert, who lived a long time ago, 1593 to 1633. So 400 years ago, I had to change a few of these words because they were spelled like an old Englishman, right? And you know how if you read old English, they're spelled funny, so fix that up a bit. I've been reading English poets over the last few years, and Herbert and Donne, John Donne, and Samuel Taylor Coleridge and others, and been immersed in the beauty of language. So here's a poem that I find stunning. Philosophers have measured mountains, fathomed the depths of the seas, of states and kings, walked with a staff to heaven and traced fountains. But there are two vast, spacious things, the which to measure it doth more behove. Yet few there are that sound them, sin and love. Who would know sin? Let him repair unto Mount Olivet, and there shall he see a man so wrung with pains that all his hair, his skin, his garments bloody be. Sin is that press and vice which forceth pain to hunt his cruel food through every vein. Who knows not love, let him assay and taste that juice which on the cross a pike did set again a broach. Then let him say, if ever he did taste the like, love is, it should be is there, love is that liquor sweet and most divine, which my God feels as blood, but I as wine. Okay, well, it might rush over you quickly. And you might say, whoa, that was like drinking from a fire hydrant. I didn't catch all that. So, first stanza, what does he say? This is written before the scientific age, or just at the beginning of the scientific age. But he's really saying that human beings have tried to investigate the world in all the ways they can. They've tried dearly to do that. But he says there are two really big things that would help us to pursue a little bit more, right? Or to investigate. And he says, sin and love. I don't think we can know what's wrong with the world unless using some word like sin, the mystery of sin, the mystery of what's wrong. It's not in our systems, right? Something happened. Something's going on with us. We got infected somehow. There's something bigger. In fact, you could say it's around us, it's in us, and it's deeper than we know. So I always refer to that image from The Lord of the Rings, the movies, and I've read the novels three times. Did it just again a year or so ago. But in the movie edition, in the second installment, when Gandalf has been knocked off, you know, the Bridge of Khazad Dûm, and he's hurtling into the earth. Do you remember that scene? You guys have seen all that? And he's got his sword out, and he's just going to the heart of the earth, right? Ah! The heart of his sword plummeting into the depths, right? It's deeper than we know. Jesus has done more than we know. We hardly can describe what he has done, but it's deeper than we know. So it's around us, it's in us, and it's deeper, it's bigger and deeper than we know. And Herbert says, these are the big things, sin and love. And then he says, if you want to know sins, if you want to know sin, then he takes our eyes and he says, let's look at Jesus. And he mentions Mount Olivet, the beginning of his sufferings, Gethsemane, right? Gethsemane meaning the oil press, right? Where Jesus begins to endure his sufferings. It's in Gethsemane. And then from there, he's led away, of course, to his trial and his crucifixion. But you see here the picture of his sufferings and all that proceeds from his trial and his beatings and his crucifixion. Then he says this, sin is that press and vice. You know, vice, you know what a vice is, where you put something, you clamp it down. But we have that sense of a vice being the opposite of a virtue, right? So it has this double meaning here. But he says it forceth pain. Pain is an interesting thing. Pain is not simply what is wrong. Sometimes we think pain is the problem, but pain is the pointer, most likely, right? Pain signifies that something is wrong. Many times we're trying to, in our present age, just solve pain, but pain is the pointer that something's going on, whether it's in the soul or whatever it is. So we're seeing here what sin does. It separates and kills and takes apart. We're seeing it in the person of Jesus here as he takes upon himself the sin of the world. Someone said one time that the cross is the giant sponge that sucks in the sins of the world. You know, that moment where the land becomes dark and it's almost like all the sin of eternity, you know, from the beginning of humanity to the end is all brought and laid upon Jesus' body. But then Herbert says, at the same moment and in the same place, he says, if you don't know love, then let's take a careful look there. That's the word to say. And now in the same place on the cross where you're seeing the result of sin, you're seeing the proof of love. In the same place. And he says, this spear that opened up Jesus and his blood ran out, he says that liquor sweet. It's a strange poetic expression, isn't it? God's blood is my wine. What is he saying there? He's saying that there's an amazing exchange that we can't quite fathom. We try to describe it in our theological constructs or our poetic words, but it really is the deeper magic. It really is something is going on that's transforming the world. Something we could never even look at unless we understood that this was a part of love. I don't know if you've watched The Passion of the Christ. I've watched it probably 5 or 6 times, and every time I get ready to watch it, I go, oh, Lord, steal my energies for this moment. And the only way I can do it is because it's not a hopeless or tragic story. It is actually the revelation of God solving the deepest problem of the world and through the offering, the self-giving of Jesus for us. And if you watch that film closely, you see how it begins to transform at the end, where somehow something is happening to the soul as you watch that. A wondrous exchange. All right. We come to the end. This is Holy Week. This is Maundy Thursday. Here's the last thing I want to say about what is wrong with the world. And it's in that last clue. It would be terribly wrong if history ended now. If this was all we knew about things. But this is why I want to anchor us now in the story arc. Every story arc will take you through various moments and passages and experiences. And what needs to happen in the story arc is you follow it through to its proper conclusions. So this is what the communion moment immerses us in. And there's this lovely, image from the Passover meal, which, of course, Jesus is celebrating with his disciples, right? And the Last Supper is the Passover meal, now reconstituted through Christ for us. But there is this reading from Exodus 6, 6 and 7, which I have there, which at the Jewish Passover Seder is still read and celebrated. There are the four cups of the Passover meal. And so I underlined them, how they're each celebrated. I think I said this to you in worship last fall, but I just thought I would bring it back here. This is what it says in Exodus 6. Therefore, say to the Israelites, I am the Lord. I will bring you out. That's the first one. I'll bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. And then finally, I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. And then you will know that I am the Lord your God who brought you up out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. So four cups in the Passover meal. I will bring you out. I will free you. I will redeem you. And what we understand is that the cup that Jesus took and celebrated with his disciples was the third cup, the cup of redemption. But then he says, remember, especially in Matthew's gospel, this is recounted, he said, I'm not going to drink this cup again until we drink it in the kingdom of my Father. The final cup, when God takes us to be his people, and every tear is wiped from the eye, and every wrong is reversed into that which is right. All is resolved and all is made well. There is this sense where if we only stop now after the third cup, we would entirely misread the story. And we wouldn't understand. It would be a wrong to stop the story now. Everything would be wrong. There's too many loose ends. There's too many irreconciled things. There's too many things that don't make sense. The only way that it can be righted is for us to finish all the way. And in the way that only God can do, he will bring all of this into some kind of understanding that we will only praise. In fact, that's the last cup, is the cup of praise. That's literally what the Jewish people call it, that fourth cup. They're waiting for that. Israel is waiting for that. The Christian church has been let in on the secret that he's already redeemed us and forgiven us. So the cup that Jesus took in Passover 30 AD on the night he was arrested and on the day before he was put to death is the third cup of redemption, the fourth of which is still to come. This is the truth that we can't really understand what is wrong with the world completely until all is resolved. And we can't fully understand how God deals with all that is wrong until the resolution of all things. So that's our final clue. And the text really says there, I don't know if you see it there, then you will know. Then you will know. You see that? Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. Then you will know. So we're going to take communion together tonight. And we're going to ask that you come and take of the bread and receive from us the cup. And we're going to do this as an act of worship. And then we'll say a final prayer. And that will be our night together. So
team takes them.
Yeah, and the worship team is going to come and help us.
Maybe if you guys want to take up first as well.
So on the night that Jesus was betrayed, he took bread and he broke it. And he said, this is my body, which is given for you. And the same way after supper, he took the cup and he said, this is the new covenant in my blood, which is for you. So as you come, we're going to give you the bread and the wine, and we're going to ask that you just return to your seat and take them as we worship. Okay.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. We hope that this has helped you to think about what's wrong with the world, but also ask, what's right with the world? Hope to see you next week on April 11th at 7 p.m. at Brentview Baptist Church for the Convergence as Paul Verhoef shares about what's right with the world. See you there.